The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, our first destination is somewhat unusual in that it's an unlikely choice unless you've run afoul of the law. Outside Chicago, historic old Joliet Prison is open for tours, at least for now. It was written by Chicago-based writer Genevieve Bookwalter and appeared in the April 12, 2019 issue of the Washington Post. So let's begin. At the start of the Blues Brothers, the 1980 comedy classic, Joliet Blake, Blues, walks out of the front gate of Joliet Correctional Center, a looming limestone fortress built in 1858. Now, for the first time since the facility closed in 2002, tourists can walk in through that gate. The old Joliet Prison, as it's known locally, is offering public tours. But the prison outside Chicago is not the Alcatraz of the Midwest. It hasn't been spruced up with exhibits and an audio tour. There is no heat or jail cell restoration. Instead, it is a tourist experience in ruin porn, that's in quotes, the trendy photography genre that showcases abandoned and decaying buildings. And the Joliet Area Historical Museum hopes visitors will pay $20 each to walk through and listen to tales from local historians and former prison guards. "It literally looks like someone just got up and walked away from the prison," said Greg Pierbolt, executive director of the museum, which is coordinating the tours. "The forbiddenness is definitely an asset. There's a voyeuristic aspect," he says. Indeed, a pair of shorts lie on the floor of a cell left there by a former prisoner or an actor in one of the shows that filmed in the prison after it closed. Peeling paint drapes down from the ceiling. In the former hospital, built in 1895, one of the oldest buildings on the yard, grime and graffiti tags cover exam room walls. The 90-minute walking tour starts at the gate where Jake, John Belushi, walks out of the prison and across the street to meet his brother Elwood, Dan Aykroyd, who is waiting to pick him up. The prison walls, more than 20 feet high, back right up to the street surrounding them, and the gate opens onto the roadway. I couldn't help but crane my neck at the tall limestone barriers as I went in. "The prisoners built this around themselves," Pierbolt said from the center of the 16-acre yard, motioning to the walls that surrounded us. "Prisoners mined the rock from a nearby quarry, carried it here, and walled themselves in. Inside the fortress, the scenery still looks much like it did in a season one episode of Prison Break, the Fox television series that was filmed here." Pierbolt credits the series and the John Landis film with driving much of the tourism the prison is experiencing, especially from international visitors. The museum already has booked a 200-ticket block this summer with a tour operator based in China, where Prison Break is very popular. "A man visiting from Italy spoke no English," Pierbolt said, "except to ask where John Belushi's cell was. When he found it, he broke down in tears. The man talked about how he'd waited his whole life to see it," Pierbolt said. "I'm like, you're from Rome, the cradle of civilization?" Jessamine Moore, the museum's internal operations manager, said she has started recommending that docents watch the shows not only to brush up on pop culture, but to learn what the prison looked like before the decay set in. As the tour continues around the yard, visitors can read lines engraved above the doorways. "Make time serve you," greets visitors to the old school. "Make ye a new heart and a new spirit," Ezekiel 18:31, is emblazoned above the chapel. Etched into the floor of the segregation unit, which held cells for prisoners in solitary confinement, are the words that famously appear in the movie's final scene, "It's never too late to mend." The building was designed by Chicago architects William W. Boyington and Otis L. Wheelock in the castellated Gothic style. The second oldest prison in Illinois, built to house 1,800 people, was already over capacity at nearly 2,000 inmates by 1878, Pierbolt said. In Joliet Prison's Images in Time, Local historian Robert E. Sterling chronicles the dramatic changes at the facility during the decades it was in operation. Until 1896, black and white striped pants, shirts, and hats were standard issue, and prisoners were forced to walk in lockstep. There was no separate facility for young offenders. In 1864, for example, the ages of inmates living in the prison ranged from 10 to 68 years old. Until 1903, when the dining hall was built, the men ate in their cells. Before showers were installed in the 1920s, prisoners bathed once a week in the summer and once every 2 weeks in the winter in the prison's 15 iron tubs. To save time, some were forced to share a soak. By 1915, prisoners were allowed 1 hour of daily outdoor recreation. Strict quiet time during meals, work, and marching was lifted, and inmates could talk to one another. The prison launched a day school and its own newspaper, and trusted inmates were allowed outside the walls to work on a farm, growing food for the prison, according to Sterling's book. But many of those allowances were eliminated after prisoners rioted in 1917 and set fire to 7 buildings. Our next stop was a cell that was preserved and put on display in the prison yard when the facility was decommissioned. A plaque next to the cell calls Joliet the last of the Illinois medieval prisons. It held iron bunk bed frames for mattresses barely wide enough to roll over on. The room was 4 feet wide, 7 feet long, and 7 feet high. These cells were in use until the late 1940s and early 1950s when they were remodeled and replaced. I declined the offer to step inside. Just peering in made me want to run in the other direction. Pierbolt said many people have a similar response. We also visited the cells for solitary confinement, which were a little bigger because, Pierbolt said, prisoners were allowed outside for only an hour a day. Others spent more of their day at work or in the yard. In the chapel, a mid-century modern building across the yard, sunlight streamed in through smashed windows and illuminated a roughly hewed altar that was probably built by prisoners. The variety of architectural designs, Pierbolt said, is common as the prison was added unto and improved to meet the changing needs over time. The limestone is constant throughout the prison's buildings. The question of what to restore, what to remodel, and what to save is key to the future of the facility, officials agreed. The answer could determine how far into the future the tours will be offered. Steve Jones, deputy city manager and economic development manager for the city of Joliet, said the city and the museum have a 5-year intergovernmental agreement with the Illinois Department of Corrections to research whether the prison is worth preserving as a community asset, and if so, how to do it. The Illinois Department of Corrections still owns the site. Along with the historical tours and the tours led by former prison guards, the museum staff is considering tours for amateur photographers and private groups and even ghost tours, Moore said. The staff has received inquiries from folks representing travel channels and conducting paranormal explorations, as well as film crews from various networks, Jones said. Empire recently filmed on site. Joliet's minor league baseball team, the Slammers, filmed their promotional video there. A concert held on the prison yard last summer drew 3,500 people and raised $137,000. Pierbolt said he's even had inquiries about getting married in the chapel. Think of all the ball and chain jokes, he said. There are many other sections of the prison, such as the former warden's quarters, that remain off limits, but could be a big draw for tours once they're restored. People lived and died here. This is a house of pain, Jones said, but it's also one that holds more than a century of history and served as one of the city's largest employers. People need to use, or rather see, this space, he says. And by the way, Bookwater, our writer, is based in Chicago, and she has a Twitter account if you'd like to follow more of what she writes about. It's Genevieve Book. Genevieve is G-E-N-E-V-I-E. E-V-E, Genevieve Book, at Genevieve Book, where you can find her on Twitter. Now, if you'd like to go to this Old Joliet Prisons tour, here's a couple of things to know. It's at 1125 North Collins Street in Joliet, Illinois. Online, you can check it out at JolietPrison.org. That's JolietPrison.org, spelled J-O-L-I-E-T. The Old Joliet Prison was built in 1858 and held thousands of prisoners during its more than 140 years in use. Tours go from April through October. Non-refundable tickets cost $20 each for a 90-minute tour. Guests must be 10 or older. Closed-toe shoes are required. Tours happen rain or shine. And if you want more information, you can email info@joliettmuseum.org. That's info@joliettmuseum.org. And you send that email 72 hours before the tour for special accommodations. And if you want more information about Joliet, you can try enjoyillinois.com. That's enjoyillinois.com. Well, maybe a tour of the old Joliet is a bit less travel-friendly than you desire. Okay. The editors of the June-July 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler offer a best list of the friendliest neighborhoods. Now, this list is based on the question, where are the most welcoming urban enclaves in the U.S.? Writer-editor Jennifer Barger and her colleagues start with an overview of what to expect, along with an explanation of how they came up with their list. Here's the introduction. Travel is rooted in hospitality and a welcoming gesture, a friendly smile, and accommodating spirit. In search of these qualities, we've developed, with the help of our data-crunching partners at Renaissance Consultancy, this unique index of the 28 friendliest city neighborhoods in the U.S. And then we'll be switching to how they did this methodology and so forth. And it says that whether embracing its immigrant roots, San Jose's Japantown, for example, or celebrating inclusion like Manhattan's Hell Kitchen, an open-minded, open-hearted neighborhood can make travelers feel at home. This ultimate list offers starting points to explore American cities, enclaves full of places to delve into, people to meet, and enough, bon ami, to make you want to return again and again, okay? Well, let's talk a little bit first about the methodology used, then we'll get to the list. In a survey created just for Traveler, Vancouver-based Renaissance Consultancy combined its proprietary Best Cities analytics from more than 200 cities with statistics and user-generated data such as walkability, home affordability, public spaces, and the prevalence of third spaces, restaurants, breweries, cafes, and more. Renaissance also considered social media and perception data from TripAdvisor and Yelp to generate a list of welcoming zip codes that the editors then correlated with the existing neighborhoods to produce the best list. And now on to the list of friendliest neighborhoods. It's going to start with Albuquerque, New Mexico. Rose gold adobe buildings such as the 1973 San Felipe de Nere Church ring the central plaza of Albuquerque's historic Old Town, established as a Spanish colonial outpost in 1706. Tour the neighborhood on Roots Rentals, bike past galleries, souvenir shops, and restaurants like Golden Crown Panaderia for a zippy green chili bread and the local microbrews. Dig deeper into the region's history and culture at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center with its weekend dance demos and restaurants serving Native American dishes. Try the fry bread tacos. On to Anchorage, Alaska next. Just southeast of downtown, Rogers Park lures bike commuters, runners, and cross-country skiers with its easy access to the paved 4-mile Chester Creek Trail, prime territory for moose spotting. And then we have Asheville, North Carolina. Afro-American businesses once thrived around the block, that's in quotes, Eagle Street and East End. Now older establishments, barbershops, cafes, mingle with newcomers like the Foundry Hotel. Explore with Hood Huggers Tours. Then we move to Austin, Texas. A grinning 8-foot-tall statue of Willie Nelson holds court outside the Moody Theater, where Austin City Limits has been filmed since 1974, and music fans can attend tapings and concerts. He is in the heart of the 2nd Street District, a guitar pick's throw from Artie Violet Crown Cinema and indie businesses. Kid-friendly boutique Toy Joy or French bistro Le Politique with its pretty pastel decor. Stay at the New Line Hotel in a redone mid-century building. Then we have Boise, Idaho. In the tree-rich north end, Hyde Park leads to Camelsback Park, a family-friendly 11-acre green space with access to this outdoorsy city's extensive ridges to rivers trail system. Tri-Town Bicycles rents wheels, if you prefer. Boston, Massachusetts, the Boston Marathon, Red Sox parades, and locals in search of chow or shopping hit the byways of Back Bay. Surrounding blocks house Beantown originals such as cozy decades-old Trident Booksellers and Cafe. Charleston, South Carolina is next on the list. In the 17th century, Huguenots, French Protestants, fled religious persecution in Europe and found solace and a new home in the Carolinas. Charleston's French Quarter, bounded by Broad Street to the south and the City Market to the north, encompasses steepled churches, columned civic buildings, and pale-colored houses, as well as art galleries and plush hotels. Southern food mecca Husk is still a coveted reservation. At the quarter's eastern edge, Waterfront Park's Pineapple Fountain is an homage to the colonial symbol for hospitality. And then we have Chicago, Illinois. Onion-domed Orthodox churches and restaurants serving varenyky, potato dumplings, point to Ukrainian villages' Eastern European roots. Adjoining Wicker Park buzzes with independent boutiques, upmarket restaurants, and the Flatiron Arts Building with studios and performance spaces. Colorado Springs, Colorado is next on the list, and the 101-year-old Broadmoor Resort towers above Broadmoor / Stratton Springs, a mountain-framed zone that's also known for Seven Falls, a soaring box canyon with trails and waterfalls. Then on to El Paso, Texas. Nestled against the Mexican border are two of El Paso's oldest neighborhoods, Chihuahuita and El Segundo Barrio. Developed in the late 19th century by immigrants fleeing the Mexican Revolution, outdoor murals depicting Hispanic culture, Conjunto Acayon players, Aztec temples, pepper El Segundo Barrio, nicknamed the Ellis Island of the Border. Download the free Visit El Paso app for a guided walking tour of the murals. Afterward, grab a bowl of menudo at Jalisco Cafe. And then we have Honolulu, Hawaii. Waikiki's 2 miles of powdery sand hosts some of the world's easiest-to-ride waves and best surf teachers. Like Tony Menez at the Faith Surf School, the hike to the top of Diamond Head yields Pacific Ocean vistas. Then we have Houston, Texas. Mid-century bungalows and turreted Victorian houses draw young couples and singles to walkable the Heights, an older neighborhood, a short bike trail ride north of downtown Houston. Restaurants, many in vintage buildings, specialize in tacos, Vietnamese sandwiches, or Texas brisket. Try the New Truth Barbecue. 19th Street is lined with quirky coffee shops and local retailers, including AG Antiques, a decor emporium, and an old dry goods store. The Art Car Museum exhibits lavishly tricked out wheels as well as local and international contemporary artwork. Now on to Las Vegas, Nevada. Count gourmets and performing arts fans among those enticed to the Strip. Sin City's ever-changing 4.2-mile ribbon of mega hotels, glitzy live shows, and good-willed hucksterism. Entertainers encamped for the summer include Cirque du Soleil's O at the Bellagio and Janet Jackson's Metamorphosis show at Park MGM through August 10th. The jumbo millennial-focused Park MGM development hawks Italian snacks and sizzle at Eataly or L.A. Korean Bar Fare at celebrity chef Roy Choi's Best Friend. Los Angeles, California, downtown L.A. with a vibrant sub-neighborhoods like Little Tokyo and the Arts District shows off diverse restaurants, Egg Slut, Sake Dojo, and galleries, Hauser & Wirth. A slew of urbane hotels open this year, too. Then we have Madison, Wisconsin next. During University of Wisconsin football games, the cheers of Badger fans echo through the leafy lakefront university area around campus. In summer, Lake Wengra offers a kayak rentals and the Madison Log Rolling School. Miami, Florida. Gleaming high-rises dominate the Brickell Hammock skyline. This downtown neighborhood is known for Biscayne Bay views, Bafo shopping at the Brickell Center Mall, and glitzy lounges like Rooftop Sugar for a Pan-Asian fare. Then we move to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. A 187-foot-tall Ferris wheel rotates above Myrtle Beach's kid-pleasing downtown boardwalk. Slightly farther afield, the new Market Common development has cool local shops and cafes on a former Air Force base. And our best list of friendliest neighborhoods continues now in Naples, Florida. This Tony Gulfside City's 1,000-foot-long pier and surrounding Old Naples Historic District summon glamorous bygone Florida via vintage sorbet-hued bungalows, posh boutiques, and tropical plant-shaded outdoor cafes. Walking tours depart from the circa 1895 Palm Cottage, a tabby shell and sand concrete stucco charmer with a museum, and on the site of a 1920s oyster processing plant on Naples Bay, funky Tin City hosts shops and crab shacks in brightly painted metal-roofed cottages. New York, New York, Times Square is such a world's crossroads that can make it such a friendly, accepting place whether you're into Broadway, music, or whatever, says Ben Bodoli, Vice President of Brand Experience at Edition Hotels. The brand opened an outpost in 2015 near Midtown's most famous intersection, further cementing the spiffed-up rep of the theater, chain store, and selfie talking hub. Just to the west, LGBTQ-friendly Hell's Kitchen heats up with lively bars and restaurants, including new pescatarian hotspot Gloria. Omaha, Nebraska. West Omaha's Boys Town was founded as an orphanage by Roman Catholic priest Edward Flanagan in 1917. Tours of the historic site, still a home for at-risk youth, take in Flanagan's 1929 house and a museum with artifacts such as the Oscar statuette Spencer Tracy won for playing Flanagan in the 1938 movie Boys Town. And on to Orlando, Florida next, on the southeast corner of Lake Eola Park. Dog-friendly sidewalk cafes, live music spots, and a Saturday farmer's market lend colorful Thornton Park an urban walkable vibe. Get your art fix at Falcon Bar and Gallery. Then we jump across the country to San Diego, California. It's not all old-school red sauce restaurants in Little Italy. Year-old Little Italy food hall, try the Melanese-style pizza at Ambrosio 15. Ballast Point Brewery and a Saturday Farmer's Mercato attract foodies and families. Then San Francisco, California, Italian immigrants, beat poets, and jazz musicians have all found refuge in North Beach. Despite tourist crowds at City Lights Bookstore and Coit Tower, the Nona and Pop warmth remains. It's Italian with a West Coast vibe, says Thomas Medlin, whose local taste of the city tours munched through spots like Stella Pastry and Mario's. Daytime browsers head to Lola for groovy greeting cards and A.B. Fitz for denim. Music variety drag queen show Beach Blanket Babylon, now in its 43rd year, packs them in at night. San Jose, California. Anyone can join the hundreds of costumes, paper fan-wielding dancers who crowd Japantown's North 5th Street during San Jose's annual Obon Festival, July 13th and 14th this year, a traditional Japanese Buddhist party honoring ancestors. The 8-block area, one of the three official Japantowns in the U.S., offers taste of the immigrant culture all year at sushi bars, family-run groceries, and the Shuedo Manju Shop, which serves rice flour sweets in flavors such as cherry blossom. The Japanese American Museum of San Jose explores local history. Now back to Savannah, Georgia. Graceful 18th and 19th century homes and waterfront warehouses fill Savannah's North Historic District. The neighborhood features Hopping River Street, where dueling candy shops push free praline samples, and lodging such as the new Alida Hotel, named for an early preservationist. Storied mansions are open for tours like the Owens Thomas House and Slave Quarters Museum, where Regency architecture and artifacts contrast with exhibits on slavery. Seattle, Washington. Gay Pride Rainbows mark several crosswalks in Capitol Hill, where many of Seattle's artists and hipsters hang out. Creative energy pulses, especially in the Pike Pine Zone, with live music clubs and vintage shops. Then on to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Early 20th century oil tycoons erected an impressive clutch of Art Deco buildings in this river city's downtown. It's adjacent to Tulsa Arts District, with galleries like 108 Contemporary and music-filled Guthrie Green Park. And our final stop is Washington, D.C., stretching along its main drag, 14th Street, up to U Street. The Logan Circle neighborhood hums with design-centric shops and dozens of restaurants in early 20th century and contemporary buildings. Snag a coveted rooftop spot, a colada shop for a Cuban cocktail, an empanada, or sparse through old postcards and 1960s lamps at Miss Pixie's Furnishings and whatnot. I love walking down 14th Street on a nice day when people spill out of restaurants onto the sidewalk, says Amanda McClements, resident and owner of neighborhood decor shop Salt and Sundry. So quite a trip there, huh? Wow. Neat, neat. Well, perhaps you'd like to consider for your summer travel a more traditional destination, maybe one that's anchored in American history. How about Laura Randall writing in the January 3rd, 2019 issue of the Washington Post? And she says, skip the Liberty Bell and head to Franklin Court for acquired or historical experience. And we'll read an excerpt of her article. At the Liberty Bell, long lines and large crowds. Philadelphia's iconic bronze bell sits at the heart of what is often called the most historical square mile in America. On one side of the Liberty Bell Center is Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was signed. On the other side is a huge visitor center with a souvenir shop, Rocky statue, costume lookalikes of Betsy Ross and President Thomas Jefferson. Tourists, double-decker buses, and horse-drawn carriages jam the cobbled streets, or cobblestone streets. Unlike Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell Center is free and doesn't require time tickets. Visitors simply line up on a first-come, first-served basis. The wait to see the bell, however, can be much longer than the time spent viewing it. Once you make it inside, you have to go through security, then wave through exhibit viewing crowds before reaching the cordoned-off bell. There, you'll join dozens of other tourists taking selfies or scrutinizing the famous crack and have maybe 3 seconds to get a clear photograph before the next group swoops in. If this seems overwhelming, if you are accompanied by small kids or impatient grown-ups, or if the federal shutdown is in effect still when this was written, consider viewing the bell from outside. If you bypass the entrance near Market Square and head to the window on the east side near Chestnut Street, you'll have a good, albeit glassed-in, view of the bell. There is a bonus. You can do this beyond the pavilion's daily 9-to-5 hours to get a clear shot or play with the effects offered by sunsets and nighttime shadows. By the way, it's located at the Liberty Bell Center, 526 Market Street. And online, you can gain more information at nps.gov/INDE/planyourvisit/libertybellcenter.htm. Once again, that's nps.gov/INDE/planyourvisit/libertybellcenter.htm. And at Franklin Court, kid-friendly historical experiences for a less hectic historical experience had 2 blocks east to the quiet of Franklin Court off Market Street. Like the Liberty Bell Center, it's part of Independence National Historic Park, but it doesn't draw the same crowds. This might be due to its location down an unobtrusive brick alley that its namesake, Benjamin Franklin, would pass through on his way home. The Founding Father's mansion is long gone, but the complex includes a steel ghost structure of his house and grandson Benjamin Franklin Bache's newspaper office and bindery, which offers kid-friendly printing demonstrations on 18th-century presses and floor portals that peek into the home's original cellar kitchen. There's also a frozen-in-time post office that commemorates Franklin's colonial-era role as Postmaster General, occupying a 3-story row house that's the only operating post office in the country that does not fly the U.S. flag because it didn't exist during Franklin's tenure, and all mail is stamped with Be Free Franklin, his original 1775 postmark. It's usually hushed inside with a single colonial-era garbed clerk on duty and a small exhibit of postal artifacts, quills, and inkwells for addressing postmarks. Cards. And that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I have been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.